This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Refrain from unwholesome action, do wholesome action. Purify your own mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. Master Dogen taught that unwholesome action is a manifestation of one of the three natures, the wholesome action nature, the unwholesome action nature, and the neutral nature. The unwholesome action nature is unborn, just as the wholesome action nature and neutral nature are unborn. These three natures are also non-defiled and are reality. However, these three natures are manifested in various ways. Because of how our minds and our bodies are constructed, we experience things in terms of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, or what is neutral. What is pleasurable, what is unpleasant, and what we're indifferent to. And what Dogen is saying here is that these three natures have a particular essence. Wholesome, you know, can suggest, I don't know, whatever it suggests to you. It's basically, wholesome is all that is life-affirming. Unwholesome is all that is destructive of life. Wholesome is all that is sort of contributes or feeds into awakening, to liberation, to manifesting compassion, being of service. And unwholesome is everything that works counter to those. And neutral is things that pass by without much effect, influence, or things that we're actually numb to, indifferent to, apathetic about. But wholesome means in English to be healthy, to be life-giving, to be that which is good for oneself and for others, nourishing, uncontaminated. And in an ethical, more spiritual sense, it's that which is ethical, that which is morally grounded, virtuous, uplifting, decent, harmless. And what Dogen is saying is that all of these qualities and everything that is unwholesome, which essentially creates suffering, that its nature itself is unborn. And so too of all things that are positive, that are beneficial, and all things that are neutral. And that each of these ways of experiencing all things are non-defiled, are undefiled, and are reality itself. So to really reflect on the deep nature of what is being said here, the implications of this, that every action, everything, every phenomena, anything we can experience, delusion, enlightenment, all are unborn and undefiled in our reality. When the Diamond Sutra teaches, in the three worlds there is not a single thing, is saying the same thing, that all things have one nature, unconditioned and conditioned. All have one nature, unborn and undying. Bodhidharma says it this way: when we see reality as it is, then everything that before appeared false or untrue is now realized as true. But true here doesn't mean good or moral or uplifting or harmless. True means true in and of itself, true in its own nature. And that nature is the nature of everything. And that's why Dogen says, however, these three natures, that is all phenomena, are manifested in various ways. In ways that create harm, in ways that bring joy to the world. The Buddha, in his enlightenment, realized, sort of radicalized thought, radicalized desire, in realizing that intention is the source of karma, is the origin of karma, is karma itself. The Buddha said, intention, I tell you, is karma. Intending, one creates karma by way of your body, by your words, and by your speech and your mind. He goes on to say, not by birth is one a Brahmin or an outcast, speaking to those social positions of his time, but rather by deeds. Not by birth is one a saint or a sinner, is one high or low, is one important or unimportant, but rather by one's deeds. And so the power of intention is a desire that is expressed in our mind with the purpose of fulfillment. So we may have a desire, but intention is to, within a consciousness, within our consciousness, to sort of bring forth that desire in a focused way with a purpose to fulfill it. It's like the desire is made active towards its fruition. And so these fundamental precepts, because this is so, refrain from unwholesome action, unwholesome intentions. Do wholesome action, bring forth beneficial intentions. And in order that we can do this, in order for this to be possible, really, we have to study our mind. We have to see the arising of that desire, of that thought, of that intention, and see its basis. So one aspect, sort of the first level of that basis is it arising out of fear, out of anger, out of hatred, out of pride, out of jealousy? Or is it arising out of patience, out of the desire to serve, out of loving kindness, out of generosity? So to see it's not just its energy, but the desire within the desire. And ultimately to see its very basis, which is that it's empty, unborn. The power that it has is both the power that we give it, but it's also the power that comes with it, we might say. Because of all of our past experiences with that desire, as well as because of how that desire appears within this particular time and place. This place, this time in our world, in our country, in our culture. All of that is present in giving that desire power, and in that way directing it towards its fulfillment. And so that's why studying our mind is so essential. To understand karma and to be actively engaged in not just studying our thoughts, studying those intentions and desires, but beginning to direct them, to work with them in a way that they're helping us to move along the path. And so that means seeing the basis, seeing the desire, seeing its arising, seeing the intention that is formed, and then the results of that desire, are acting upon it, the consequences. And so really, right effort, so many of our practices and teachings are about ceasing from harm, letting go of those desires, those intentions, those words, those thoughts and actions that are strengthening our suffering, our confinement, our hesitation, restrictedness, and bringing forth the very same functions of our, in a sense, the seats of our power, but towards our letting go, our non-attachment, our gaining insight, our compassion. As I said, intention is a result of and is preceded by, that doesn't just appear suddenly from nowhere. And so it's a result of and is preceded by all of our previous karmic streams, previous desires, intentions. So in the same way that in order to be angry, in order to be joyful, in order to be sad, the seeds of those various emotions have to already be present within us. They don't just appear from nowhere. And so we have experiences that are in our mind, are in our consciousness, and then in a sense are both stimulating and stimulated by these seeds that already exist within our consciousness before. So we can think of intention as a kind of a force, as a force. And so if you think of all the ways in which intention is brought forth, so we start with the God of Atonement. So recognizing all of the hurtful karma that we've ever created in the whole of our life, the whole of our lives, how that arises through greed, anger, and delusion. How does it come forth through our thoughts, words, and actions? Now I atone for it all. So that's the expression of a desire, of an intention to take responsibility, to atone for everything that we've done that has ever been hurtful. When we chant the names of the seven Buddhas, Namu means to be one with. That's not a static thing. In a sense, it's already true. It's already the reality of things. We are nothing other than all Buddhas, all bodhisattvas throughout space and time. But it's also because we don't yet know that, we don't yet realize that. It's an active thing. Namu means being one with. It means realizing ourselves as. It means letting go of the idea of the self that separates us, that denigrates, that creates distance, which is an expressed desire. It's an expression of a desire to have that realization, to live that way. The four vows. Sentient beings are numberless, desires are inexhaustible, the dharmas are boundless, the Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to save them, to put an end to them, to master them, to attain it, is an expression of a deep and broad desire, an intention to do that very, to do those very things, to alleviate all the suffering, to free ourselves of all clinging, to see deeply into all teachings, all truths, and to attain the way. And so we're constantly in our liturgy bringing forth those expressed intentions. And so again, it's a force. It's like harnessing this incredibly powerful, in fact, the most powerful, this is the most powerful force in the human realm, intention. And we then begin to, so first, in a sense, when we And of course, we arrive here by as a result of intention. We return as a result of intention. We begin practicing Zazen because of intention. We continue practicing Zazen because of our intention. But a lot of that is we may not be aware of, right? There's some dim awareness of wanting or seeking. And so part of practice is to bring that fully into our awareness, to realize how much power we have. To work within this vast complex of karmic universe, this karmic universe, and all of the possibilities, all of the different ways that are possible for us to move, all of the energy that's arising within us, all of the ways we can manifest that, and to begin to study and master the mind, which doesn't mean to bring it into some sort of, fearful control, but rather to begin to gain control through understanding, through patience, through gentleness, and through firmness, so that those most powerful energy, force, power that we have is being brought to bear, in a sense, towards our awakening and towards being a benefit in the world. And so it is something that we need to study, to practice, to realize. But that's not enough. We need to become very familiar with what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. You know, in the beginning it would seem like, well, that's obvious. Is it? I mean, there's so many times where we're not sure. Is this a true path? Is this desire? Is this impulse? Is this what we might call an intuition? Is it true? Should we strengthen it? Should we practice it? Or should we let it go? And so to become more and more familiar, which means we have to live it, right? I mean, we learn on the spot as it's happening every time. And because we're studying it, we're seeing more and more how it arises, what's in it, like what are we actually wanting? What is our actual intention, which is not always what we think it is or what it appears to be? How do we bring it forth? What is its consequence? And so to see into the body-mind universe of our desires and intentions. And an important part of this is so that we can also take responsibility. We can take responsibility and be empowered when we're developing this in a way that is in accord with the Dharma. And we can also take responsibility for when it's not, which is also empowering. Which means taking responsibility for all that is ethical, that is moral, that is uplifting, that is harmless, and also that which is not ethical, which is damaging, which is hurtful. Because we're empowered in both of those, in all of those instances, when we practice them. And that means one of the things that we have to be very attuned to is not only our intention, but the consequence of our action. And so within the work of oppression and anti-racism and anti-sexism, there's intention and there's impact. And this is so important because as Buddhists, because of the power of the Buddha's teaching and his realization that karma is intention, intention is karma, we can misunderstand that to mean, okay, if I've just got my intention in the right place, then the consequence of that, doesn't really matter because my intention is good. And that's not true. My intention may be good, and it may also be misguided. It may be coming from a clear place in part, and it may also be coming from an unclear place. And so we may have an intention to be kind or to be helpful, but we're not aware. We're not paying attention. Or we're really, that impulse or that intention to be kind or helpful may be really sort of in our mind as an idea of something, and that idea of something might be you or the situation or what I think is supposed to happen. And so I'm not actually in contact. I may not be in contact with myself. I may think that I am clear in my intention, but if I keep paying attention, if I study that stream of action and consequence, I'll see the lack of clarity, because it will appear as some sort of, you know, discord. And this is where our conditioning, how we're socialized, our blindnesses, our prejudices become very important. When Dogen says that transmitting and receiving these teachings, these moral teachings, is a mutual activity, transmitting and receiving means to study, to practice, to realize. Mutual activity means self and other refrain from unwholesome action at the same time. Roshi used to often say, what you do and what happens to you is the same thing. We could also say, what I do, and what happens to you are the same thing. And so we can think that because I didn't mean to hurt you, I said something that hurt you, I didn't mean to hurt you, therefore your pain is not my responsibility. Right? It's your problem. Because my intention was not to hurt you. And so that's ignoring. It's cutting off my study, my practice, at the moment that my words leave my mouth. Like at that point, you know, my job is done. And it's not that intention, obviously, it's not that intention is not important. It's hugely important. But it also doesn't mean that it's clearly that it's all there is to it. And that's certainly going to be true when we're angry or fearful or reckless or selfish, that our intentions arising at such times is going to be cloudy. But it's always true, because in a sense, because we're not seeing all that is this self. When Dogen said to study the way is to study the self, you know, that doesn't just mean what appears to us of its own, you know, which can be a little bit of a passive thing where we sit and thoughts arise, sort of waiting for something to appear. And of course, that is a very essential part of our practice. But these deeper embedded, very deeply integrated aspects of our identity, how we see ourselves, which is self, but also largely socially constructed, doesn't appear to us. That's its design, right? Particularly when that not seeing those aspects of our identity are a result of and sort of put us into some sort of privileged position. And so that's why this is so important in anti-racism work and anti-sexism work and any kind of anti-oppression work. To see how, for instance, my whiteness has been placed at the center of our culture, established as the norm. You know, we never... In the white culture, we never talk about white culture. We talk about African American culture, Hispanic culture, Latino culture. Everybody else has a culture, but white folks don't have culture, right? Because white culture is just the culture. It's just everything. Everything outside of that has to be named, has to be identified, right? Because it's not the standard. And so that means those the intentions that arise out of that deep, deep, invisible, until we begin examining it, conditioning, are unseen. I don't even see them as intentions. They just appear as the world. They just appear as me. And so we could think of, you know, I was thinking about studying, you know, these structures and systems of our world in a way is analogous to studying the skandhas. You know, the skandhas, form, comes into contact with a sense organ, and there's sensation, feeling. And then very quickly there's perception, recognizing, naming, putting it into its proper place in our mind and in the world. And then there's mental formations. Do I like it? Do I not like it? Do I want more? Do I want less? What is my position? What's my strategy? And then consciousness, the whole unified sense of me. And so that's how the way we see and study the ongoing constructing process of what we call the world through mind. But we could also think of the skandhas as functioning within a system, right? A government, a company, a bureaucracy, a judicial process, an educational system, policy, right? That there is form that comes into contact with the sense organs. And of course, an institution and so on doesn't have sense organs, but in a sense, it's given a life through the people, but more so through the intentions, through the desire, through what is sought, what is wanted to be gained, and the views that those are based on. And then that gives rise to perceptions. Right? So as an institution comes into contact with people, with situations, with circumstances, right? There's feeling, you could say. So a company, right, that comes into contact with an environment or with an opposition to that company's place within an environment, right? In a sense, it has a kind of a feeling, right, that we could think of as, you know, a threat to profits, right, which is a bad thing. That's a negative feeling. And so there's the perception of that, what's causing that. There's the mental formation, what needs to be done. And then there's the consciousness, sort of the all-encompassing identity, if you will, of that business or of that agency or that institution. Right? Because everything that we build is us. Everything that we see is mind. The study of the way is to study the self. The self appears in infinite forms. When it's within our own realm, we think of them as physical, mental, psychological, emotional. But we can also think of them as social, as cultural, as political. Right? If the self is the universe, if this body and mind is the body and mind of the universe, that's not just mountains and rivers and beautiful fields and open sky, right? That's the body and mind that we want to be. But it's also governments and institutions and wars and famines. Every desire we have can only arise from this self. There is no other place. There is no other way. Every action that we give forth, that we bring forth, has impact. Sometimes the impact is very, very slight. And sometimes it remains slight, but sometimes it is slight, but because it happens over and over and over again, that impact becomes large. And some actions impact is large to begin with. And all of it arises from the self and is received by the self. Mutual activity. And that when we bring forth a desire and it ushers forth, we speak, we act. You know, it seems to move out, but every word we say, we're hearing. Every action we engage, we're also on the receiving end of that, in a sense. And so we're constantly conditioning our own mind, and so we're strengthening, influencing. And so the question becomes, of what of those three natures are those actions? That's why, from a Buddhist perspective, you know, practicing every moment is not just because it's a good practice of mindfulness. It's because in every moment, we're creating karma. In every moment, we are manifesting our influence. We are creating impact and a principle, or the principle, or in every action that I bring forth, I receive that. Right? Miscellaneous sentient beings who move in and out of my field of influence, you know, experience it now and then, a lot, not at all, depending on our level of contact. I experience it every time. Every time I speak, every time I act. And so it's a different way of looking at practicing moment to moment. When we think about that, in that each moment, we are creating our path, our practice, our life. And so to study and realize mind, Stogen begins this fascicle with, is to see our mind, my mind, your mind, and the impact that my mind has on everything. And not only to see it, but to hear, to care about that impact, and to respond. And so when that influence is good, is positive, then to strengthen that. When it's not positive, to take responsibility. That's what Vasatsu is. That's why we begin with the Gatha of Atonement. And at every step along the way, when it's moving in a positive direction, when it's not, to study, to examine, to be gaining understanding. So when we defend, you know, our intention, I'm sorry what I said hurt you, but, you know, I didn't mean it, so, is really to try and diminish my impact on you. Which is really just another way of trying to protect myself, cling to the sense of, because why would I defend it? I don't want to be that person who just hurt you. That doesn't work for me, right? I don't want to be the person that is hurting you. Therefore, I can either, you know, to defend myself and deny it is basically to really confirm my fear. To take responsibility empowers me, because now I can hear you. Now I can learn from this. Now I can study myself. Within that defensiveness, very little is possible. And so really to let go, to bring forth an undefended heart, is to practice letting go of delusion, of our attachment, of false views, of our fear, of our anger. It's to be courageous. It's to let go of the self. How powerful is that? And so Dogen says, when we refrain from unwholesome action, the power of practice is immediately actualized. This is actualized on the scale of the entire earth, the entire universe, all time, and all dharmas. How powerful is this?
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. support for your spiritual practice at home.